次再会。
美日本周举行年度首场外长防长会议，应对朝中威胁或成重点。人权组织批国际奥委会不愿就新疆强迫劳动问题进行对话。美国经历辞职潮，人们为何离开工作岗位？大家好，欢迎收看美国观察，我是平章。疫情期间，美国经历了罕见的辞职潮，人们为何纷纷离开工作岗位？我们将在今天的节目当中带您关注。美国观察的节目热线已经开通，欢迎您拨打00212029204990给我们留言，跟我们分享您对节目的看法，也告诉我们您希望看到的节目内容。首先来关注今天的新闻。美国联邦政府正在加大全国遏制新冠疫情的努力。目前在奥美克戎变种的驱动下，创纪录的感染病例有可能让医院系统不堪重负，并打乱一些学校的开学计划。美国疾病预防与控制中心主任瓦伦斯基1月5日对记者们说，美国7日平均日增感染病例大约是491700例，比前一周增加了98%。他还估计奥米克戎占全国所有病例的大约95%。拜登总统星期二敦促3500万还没有接种疫苗的成年人去接种疫苗。他提到未接种疫苗者正在占用其他患者所需要的医院病床和急诊室。最新的病例激增除了在最近几周造成大批的商业航班被取消以及娱乐和其他场所被关闭之外，美国各地公立学校寒假过后的开学计划也被打乱。美国国务卿布林肯5日与德国外长贝尔伯克会晤，双方在俄罗斯可能入侵乌克兰的问题上达成统一战线，警告这样的行动会导致严重和重大的后果。布林肯在随后的记者会上还提到了中国对立陶宛的霸凌行为。
If Russia nonetheless chooses to escalate, we will respond swiftly. The United States, Germany, and our allies and partners, including at NATO, the European Union.The G7 have been very clear that Russia will face massive consequences for renewed aggression against Ukraine. We have immediate concern the government of China's attempts to bully Lithuania, a country of fewer than 3 million people. China is pushing European and American companies to stop building products with components made in Lithuania or risk losing access to the Chinese market, all because Lithuania chose to expand their cooperation with Taiwan.Here again, this isn't just about Lithuania, but about how every country in the world should be able to determine its own foreign policy free from this kind of coercion.
Die gemeinsame Haltung von Europäern und der US-Regierung hierzu haben wir in den vergangenen Wochen bei vielen Anlässen bilateral, aber gerade auch multilateral immer wieder deutlich gemacht und gemeinsam unterstrichen, dass russisches Handeln ist mit einem klaren Preisschild gekennzeichnet.Und eine erneute Verletzung ukrainischer Souveränität durch Russland hätte schwerwiegende Konsequenzen. Diese Haltung kennt auch die russische Regierung. Und der einzige Weg aus dieser Krise, der führt, und dabei sind wir uns gemeinsam sehr, sehr einig, über den Dialog.
美国和日本宣布将在华盛顿时间1月6日举行新年度首场外长防长2+2视讯会议。美国国务院在一份新闻稿中说，本次会议将讨论强化美日同盟关系的途径，推进印太地区的自由与开放，并讨论如何应对新冠疫情、气候变化危机和其他全球性挑战。与此同时，美国和日本都对中国在东中国海和其他领域的扩张行为深表忧虑，并谋求强化同盟关系，共同应对中国的挑战。韩国和日本1月5日报告说，朝鲜进行了一次导弹试射， 与此同时，美国重申对保卫韩国和日本安全的承诺依然牢不可破。韩国联合参谋本部在一项声明中说，朝鲜当天清晨向其东部海岸附近的海域发射了至少一枚抛射体。日本海上保安厅说，这次发射可能涉及一枚弹道导弹。美军印太司令部同一天在一份声明中说，我们了解这次弹道导弹发射，并在与盟友和伙伴们密切磋商。声明说，虽然美国认为这次发射对美国的人员或领土以及对我们的盟友不立即构成威胁，但它突出了朝鲜非法武器项目对地区稳定的损害。目前还没有有关这次朝鲜导弹发射的进一步细节。澳大利亚和日本1月6日将签署一项加强防务和安全合作的条约，这一历史性的举动是美国的盟友加强合作关系、抗击来自中国不断增长的威胁的最新实例。据美联社报道，澳大利亚总理莫里森和日本首相岸田文雄周四将举行视频峰会，签署这一协议。莫里森说，协议将支撑澳大利亚武装力量和日本自卫队之间更广泛和更复杂的实际接触。美国《华尔街日报》周三报道说，澳日防务条约使澳大利亚成为继美国之后的第二个与日本签订正式防务协定的国家。这个条约包含允许澳大利亚军人进入日本。一个人权组织批评国际奥委会不愿就中国新疆人权问题与该组织接触，并称此前曾试图与国际奥委会进行私下接触，但没有得到认真对待。这个名为结束维吾尔地区强迫劳动联盟的人权组织1月4日发表声明，呼吁国际奥委会解释采取了什么样的措施，确保北京冬奥会相关的奥运品牌服装等物品的生产没有使用强迫劳动。该联盟表示，国际奥委会拒绝与该组织对话，而是依赖中国自己调查自己。美国海军亚伯拉罕·林肯号航空母舰本星期在海军上校艾米·鲍恩·施密特的指挥下离开圣迭戈出海执行任务，这是美国海军历史上首次出现由一位女性来担任核动力航空母舰的舰长。鲍恩·施密特曾经在2016年到2019年担任林肯号的执行官，也就是副舰长。此前他曾经担任第70直升海上打击中队和圣迭戈两栖船坞运输舰的指挥官。据报道，他在自己的军旅生涯当中完成了超过3000个小时的飞行。这支具有最先进的航空联队的航母打击群目前正在驶往印太地区。81岁的亚洲协会美中关系中心主任夏伟研究中国问题超过60年，他曾经陪同3位美国总统访问中国，并在1979年全程报道了邓小平访美。曾任伯克利新闻学院院长的他，在80岁的时候多了一个新的头衔，那就是小说作家。他花费30年的时间撰写了《故乡》这本书，将毕生对中国的观察融入其中。夏伟最近接受了美国之音的专访，谈论他对于这本书以及当前美中关系的看法。
Professor Shou, you talk about the change from a nonfiction writer to novel writing, and it was like gender reassignment. Could you tell us like the major adjustment that you need to make in the process?
Well, that's a question that really lies at the heart of the difference between novel and reportage, the factual nature.I spent my whole life writing books that were historical and factual. And it's a strange and I think somewhat frightening liberation to be freed of the facts. In other words, to create characters and narrative that say what you want to say, even when an actual person won't say that for you. So it was precisely that freedom that I think made me want to try to write fiction, because the more time I spent in China, the more I felt that there were issues that sort of divided the U.S. and China and separated people in ways that it was very difficult to get to in journalism or history. And what I mean to say by that is there are things that can be said maybe through literature or through people's appreciation of music or their engagement with religion, psychology, that really finally, I think, say as much about why the U.S. and China cannot get along and why China does what it does. It isn't that we haven't found the perfect policy. It's that there's some very complicated and sometimes contradictory forces at work, which almost defy anybody's easy analysis. So that's what sent me off on a 30-year odyssey into writing historical fiction.
Many parts of your novel are based on solid research, obviously, including life in Qinghai, in Beijing's alley areas, Hutong, Central Music Academy, and San Francisco, also like the restaurants and the laundromat. It may take many years accumulation, right?
A lot of the research that one does is just to live it. And I mean, I spent a lot of time in China, and my wife was Chinese. My children speak Chinese. My wife's parents still live in Beijing. So, I mean, we had friends that lived in the Hutongs, and I spent some time living there myself and just feeling that very sort of beehive-like attitude that these narrow little alleyways clustered with courtyard houses and little shops at the ends that created. And it was very unique. I think it's all gone now, or almost all gone. And then, of course, in 1981, just as China was opening up with the, reform and opening period of Deng Xiaoping, I noted that the Chinese Mountaineering Association was allowing mountain climbers to go and climb some peaks that had been closed for decades. So I thought, well, this looks interesting. So I got on one mountain climbing and trekking trip, and we ended up spending, over a month in Qinghai. And that's where I ran into the Golux, the Guola Zhuqi. And so I thought, well, let's run my character up there. That's a kind of really interesting, strange, out-of-the-way place. And it also just happens Qinghai is the headquarters for the reform through labor, re-education through labor camps, and all sorts of pieces of the Chinese gulag, the penal colony. So, I took those elements of experience that I had had in some measure and tried to weave it into the fabric of a good story.
There are quite a few Chinese characters, 中文翻译, in your novel. So for Chinese language users, it's not hard to understand, but like for American readers who are not so familiar with Chinese, what could they respond to that?
If you're trying to figure out the U.S. and China riddle, how the U.S. and China can and cannot relate to each other, one of the big challenges is the language. So I thought to try to merge these things together in some regard, at least would be a symbolic attempt to bring, the yin and yang together, the East and West, all of these contradictions. I mean, Chairman Mao loved contradictions. He wrote many, many quite interesting essays on contradictions. He saw the world as a contradiction, and indeed, the U.S. and China are a contradiction. And it's exactly the nature of that contradiction that I wanted to try to better understand since I spent my whole life living it. And, when I first went to China, initially I had to go to Taiwan to study Chinese because Americans couldn't go to China. And then I went in 1975 at last and spent several months working in a agricultural model brigade, the Dajai, Dadui, the agricultural brigade in Shaanxi province, and then in the Shanghai Electrical Machinery Factory. And the thing that's just really completely bewildered me was you could not make friends with anybody. Now, why was that? I spoke Chinese. I thought I understood Chinese. I'd spent a lot of time with Chinese in Hong Kong, Taiwan, and America. And yet it was like oil and water, separate. Well, there were reasons, and that was, so what were the reasons? The reasons were that the U.S. and China had very different narratives about each other, and Mao saw the U.S. and China as what he called an antagonistic contradiction, and it was not one that could be just solved by talking and peacefully. He saw it as one that probably had to be resolved by struggle and violence, and we're still there. This term, hostile foreign forces that the Chinese Communist Party uses to speak of that contradiction.
Lu Xun certainly plays an important role to you when approaching the big topic of China study. What are the reasons? It seems like his works are not as important as before in China. Many of his work have been out of textbook in China. What do you think about the possible reasons behind this move?
Well, Lu Xun was not a paimapi, not a panderer to the Chinese Communist Party. He was a leftist, but he did not like what he saw of sort of Leninist party structure. And he really was one of the last writers who had a deep independence, a streak of independence. And he was someone who recognized that he was caught in between all kinds of things. He was caught in between left and right, between Confucian culture and modern culture of the West, between East and West, science and all sorts of superstition. He was a wonderfully ironic, funny, witty, biting person who just didn't fit in. But Mao Zedong happened to like him. So he acquired a status, and he continued, where in actuality, I think his writing, from any Maoist perspective, deserved to be censored. So now he has been forgotten, just because he reminds people like Xi Jinping and the Chinese Communist Party that what an independent voice actually sounds like. And so I called my novel, My Old Home, Guxiang, the wonderful, wonderful Lu Xun's short story about returning home and years later as a successful writer and running into his peasant boyfriend as a boy and realizing the great class difference and the great gap that was between a very sad and beautiful story. So I felt that was a bit like what I wanted to speak of in the novel, was that in a certain sense, many Chinese are in exile. You know, they left in 1949. Many are leaving Hong Kong now. I mean, there's a huge theme of being in exile, of not being able to be comfortable on either side. You can't be there and you can't be here. And that, to me, is part of the great tragedy of China, is that it makes people choose at the same time that the world is globalizing and people are becoming accustomed to living in several cultures or two cultures at once. We now find ourselves decoupling again.
The novel covers the time period from 1949 to 1989, quite depressing time for Chinese people, actually, especially like the Li family and his friends. They are intellectuals. They are called Chou Lao Jiu that time. And if your readers feel a little bit low when reading it, what could you say to them to make the reading experience very worthy?
Well, I guess I would say that in a certain sense, Chinese history does have a lot of tragedy in it. And that's one reason the Chinese Communist Party keeps trying to change history, rewrite history to make it look better than it was. I mean, the party caused immense suffering. It did some good things too, but it caused just, 30, 40 million people died in the Great Leap Forward, and then there was a Cultural Revolution. So what I have to say is that's the way it is. And it is sort of the tragedy of China that as it came to finally find its balance and undergo this period of remarkable economic growth, it went through an awful lot of self-inflicted agony and pain and damage. And you can't deny it. And the only thing I could do in writing fiction was to try to put a little bit of humor into it, because actually I think, the Chinese have a wonderful sense of humor. It's one that they've developed as a survival mechanism, and it can't always be said in public, but there is a tremendously wry way of looking at the absurdity of much of what happened in the Chinese Communist Revolution and the pomposity and the sort of grandiose, overweening, arrogance of the way leadership and leaders unrestrained sometimes act. So I tried to create some characters sort of like up in Qinghai, little autocrats who rule their tiny, insignificant world just the way Mao Zedong and Xi Jinping rule the country.
In their relationship, Little Li, as a rebel under Mao, he seeks stability and constancy. And for Juliet, the child of a capitalist society ends with embracing the idea of great disorder under heaven. How do you get this kind of inspiration for the relationship part between Little Lee and his American girlfriend?
I think America for him, as for many Chinese, particularly in the 1980s, was this land of a different kind of liberation, of sort of freedom and spontaneity and individualism and you know, excess too. So he goes to America and he ends up with this American dancer whose whole sort of idea is to sort of overthrow the establishment, whereas Little Lee is trying to find order and steadiness. Just having come out of the Cultural Revolution, she's sort of looking for individual fulfillment and a little bit reckless. So there's a clash there between his idealization of America, you know, that expression in Chinese, you know, 中国的月亮比中国的月亮圆, the moon in America is rounder than China. I think a lot of Chinese, particularly in the 80s, had that idea. But when they came to America, of course, they realized America was a reality of its own. It was ambiguous, too. It had pluses and minuses and strengths and weaknesses. And it was a very, I think, sometimes a difficult experience. And yet to go home was a difficult experience. So then where do they go? Which side do they belong on? It's not clear.
Reviewing your research on China over the past 60 years, what do you think about the current U.S.-China relation?
I think it's surprising to me that having spent my whole life, you know, I started studying China in the 1950s when I was at Harvard, when you couldn't go there. And I didn't get to China for 20 years. That could go around the outside, enviously looking in. I used to be very envious of my Canadian friends who could go to China, but I couldn't. And I remember lying on the beach in Taipei, sort of between Taipei and Jilin, and listening to radio broadcasts. You know, that was illegal, but we did it anyway, and transistor radios coming in from China during the Cultural Revolution and dreaming of going there. And then finally, I did go there. And finally, things did come together. And the 1980s was an amazing period of openness and hope and close interaction. And then we all know what happened in 89, but then things came back again under Jiang Zemin. But under Xi Jinping, we are completely tearing the fabric apart again. And I never thought I'd see that day, that we'd return to exactly the place where I began, where you couldn't go there. Friends were disconnected, businesses had trouble, universities had to kind of disconnect. And all of the sort of interactions that we laboriously built up with foundations and NGOs and people-to-people and musical groups and you name it, they're all falling apart now. And I don't think anyone has any idea how to stop it. And that, to me, is a kind of a bitter end, just as the end in my own book is quite bitter. The hero dies.
欢迎继续收看《美国观察》。在新冠疫情横扫全球的同时，美国正在经历着罕见的辞职潮。创纪录人数的美国工人辞去工作，并且没有进入新的工作岗位。我们今天就请美国之音记者魏芝来介绍一下辞职潮背后的原因。魏芝，你好。
平常你好。
魏芝，先来给我们解释一下这个辞职潮是什么意思，它是如何体现在最新的就业数据上的？
是这样的，我们看到辞职潮呢，其实是德克萨斯农工大学的安东尼·克劳茨教授提出的一个概念。他预测呢，在新冠大流行结束、生活恢复正常的时候，将有大量的人离职。那么，美国劳工统计局昨天发布的数据显示呢，去年十一月份的时候，有大约450万人从非农业岗位 辞职，也就是说占了美国劳动力总人数大约3%，比十月份的时候多了30万。那么相比之下呢，从2000年以来一直到疫情前这20年的时间，美国辞职率其实一直是在2%上下浮动的，也就是每个月呢大概有360万人辞职。那么到11月份为止呢，去年有超过了4000万人辞职，而相比之下呢，在2020年的全年只有3630万人辞职。那么我们还看到离职大军当中呢，这个职业中期的员工，即30岁到40岁的人，离职率是最高的。
那么为什么会有这么多人离开工作岗位呢？
那我们是采访到了美国的经济学家克里斯·鲍尔丁。那他说呢，其实退休年龄人员的离职是辞职潮的原因之一。那我们一起来听一下他是怎么说的。
I think one of the issues is that we've seen a large demographic shift. There were a lot of people, you know, we'd expected the baby boomers to start retiring in the next couple of years. And I think a lot of evidence from the labor market basically says a lot of baby boomers that were going to retire were just like, hey, you know, I'm going to retire now. And I think that's one of the biggest issues is demographic shift.
那根据堪萨斯城联邦储蓄银行的数据呢，从2020年的2月到2021年的6月，退休人员数量增加了360万，也就是高于了根据疫情前的退休趋势预计的150万。那由于失业救济金和这个失业救济金的增加，还有这个纾困金的增加呢，美国人的个人储蓄率在疫情期间飙升了，那么就缓解了人们在考虑离职的时候对经济因素的担忧。那许多美国人呢，其实在疫情前使用自己多年的积蓄来维持离职之后的生活。那我们看到求职网站 JobList最近是对26000用户进行了一项调查，那有22%的人表示已经辞去之前的工作，而73%的人表示，他们正在积极的考虑这个来辞职。那我们也是采访到了一个家住华盛顿特区的人，他叫做瓦莱利·摩尔，那他曾经是一个就是健身品牌的一个产品经理。那今年8月份他也是加入了这个辞职大军。那他说呢，疫情前他就已经工作非常的繁重，那疫情之后是变得更加的变本加厉。那许多时候他发现自己除了睡觉就是在工作，没有办法把私人生活和工作隔离开。那我们一起来听一下他对当时的生活的一个概括。
I would say that like there was more expectations that there were more expectations that people would be working all the time, because what else are they going to be doing? They're stuck inside. So there was more expectation that you could jump on something after hours. And also a lot of people did, because a lot of people were bored and full of anxiety. And so they were just working. So there was kind of a tone set, I think, throughout the firm.
那根据 Jobless 调查呢，今年辞职的一些原因主要是包括了对疫情期间雇主如何对待他们的不满，以及低工资或者是缺乏福利，还有就是缺乏工作与生活的平衡。那么新冠疫情当中呢，许多人感到了倦怠感增加，心理健康状况恶化，那么人们就开始重新的审视职业路线和生活质量以及需求。那么根据美国关注职场心理健康的非营利组织 Mindshare Partners 的一个调查当中显示呢，在2021年离职的80后和90后当中，有2%的人提到了心理健康原因，而在00后当中呢，这个数据更高，为81%。那我们先听一下这个摩尔他对他自己生活的介绍。
My dad had been diagnosed with cancer, unfortunately, during the pandemic.And that just added more stress. And it got to the point where I wasn't really loving what I was doing, compounded with all my personal stresses and just not being happy with where I was going and what I was working on. And it got to the point where I was crying every day for like a month. And I'm not an emotional person.I don't really, which is kind of a problem. I don't really express my emotions as much as maybe I should. So that was like a real kind of red warning flashing light to me.
是好，非常感谢魏芝今天带给我们的详细报道。 以上就是今天美国观察的全部内容，感谢您的收看，再见。